First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop. And my name is Kazuhiko Kuroki from University of Electrical Communications in Japan. And I'll be talking about spin fluctuation mediated pairing and lattice structure sensitivity of iron-based superconductors. And my collaborators are shown here. Hiroto Musui and Hirofumi Sakakibara are my graduate students. And also I've been collaborating with Ryo Arita, sitting there, and also Professor Hiro Aoki. And I was also...
Yeah. I think you have to wear a microphone for the recording.
Yeah.
You are?
Okay, can you hear? Is it okay? Okay. And I would also like to thank Dr. Takashi Miyake for motivating us the recent study I'm going to present in my talk today. And so I'd like to start with this view graph. This is a phase diagram of the two-dimensional Hubbard model on square lattice obtained by Professor Scalapino's group in 1991. This was obtained using the fluctuation exchange method. And there's a D-wave state with a TC of the order of 0.01 T, where T is the Hopping integral. And motivated by this study and also some related studies, we have been considering some problems regarding TC. And among them are these two. One is the T prime or the firm surface shape dependence of TC when we consider this model as a model for the high TC qubits. And another issue is that can we raise the TC by modulating the lattice structure or the firm surface? And this point is related to the iron nictides, so I'll be talking mainly on this issue. So so the problem is we were considering is can we raise TC? And the idea that Ryo Arita and I was considering around the year 2000 was like this. We start with the anisotropic Hubbard model on an isotropic lattice, anisotropy in x and y direction, and there's a firm surface like this near half filling. We have a good nesting, and using this nesting, spin fluctuation arises at this wave vector large Q. So we get a D-wave superconductivity where the gap changes sine is plus minus along this Fermi surface. Now, the nodes of the gap in the D-wave superconductivity is a kind of a necessary evil in that we need to have a sign change in the gap, but at the same time, there will be nodes around these points. So in order to get rid of these nodes, we introduced a modulation along the x direction, and this folds the Brillouin zone, and we end up with two disconnected Fermi surfaces. And now the superconductivity has a gap that changes sign between the firm surface A and firm surface B. And this is the now so-called the S plus minus state. And so since the, we got rid of the nodes, we may expect higher TC using this toy model. And this is what we get. We use the fluctuation exchange method. And this is the TC plotted against the Hopping integral TX1 here. And we fix TY and TX2 at these values. And this is the typical TC obtained for the Hubbard model on square lattice using the same method. And the TC obtained for this system is much higher. And if we look at the Green's function squared, whose ridge corresponds to the Fermi surface, at Tx equals 1.3, it's the same as Tx2, there's no modulation here. At this hopping, at this value, there's a large Fermi surface. Nesting is very good. And so there's a very sharp peak in the spin susceptibility at the nesting vector. And in this case, we don't get superconductivity. We get SDW state instead. And if we introduce the modulation in the x direction, like this, Tx1 is 0.8. And in this case, a gap opens up between these two Fermi surfaces, like this. Fermi surface becomes more smaller. And the nesting becomes worse. And consequently, the spin susceptibility has a broader structure. And it is in this situation we get a superconducting state, S plus minus state. So from here, we can see that electron hole from the surface with the volume of smaller than the spread of the spin fluctuations is favorable to obtain this superconducting state, since we can make a pair scattering from here to here using this large Q, and we can also scatter it from here to here using this Q plus delta Q. So we can exploit the entire Fermi surface. So there are many scattering channels. So this seems to be the condition for obtaining this state. And having this in mind, keeping this in mind, I will now move on to the iron nitride. We have been using this five orbital model in the unfolded brilliant zone. This is for lanthanum 1111. And this is the Fermi surface for the case of 10% doping. There are two whole Fermi surfaces around the wave vector 0, 0, mainly originating from this large XZ and YZ orbitals. I refer to X and X, large X and large X, Y, and Z refer to the axis in the original unit cell that contains two irons per unit cell. And there's also this electron Fermi surface beta 1, beta 2, whose character is mainly X squared minus Y squared around these portions and has a more stronger X, Z, Y, Z character near the brilliant zone edge. And there's also another band almost touching the Fermi level at this doping concentration, which mainly originates from this large X squared minus Y squared band. And the originating Fermi surface or pseudo Fermi surface will be called the gamma Fermi surface around pi pi. And actually, this band structure is sensitive to the lattice structure. And we've been focusing on the nitrogen height dependence, the height measured from the iron planes. And when the nitrogen is at high positions, this, the x squared minus y squared band rises up around pi pi, and this gives this gamma from the surface around pi pi. But when the nitrogen, the position becomes low, then this band sinks below the Fermi level, and in turn, another band having a z squared character rises up.
So what's the energy below? I mean, what's the energy scale?
Well, it's shown here. It's about, for example, it's about 0.2 or 3 electron volt. So, this is in units of electron volt. Yeah.
Z square means that you have a spherical Fermi surface close to particular KZ point, right?
Z square, what?
When you have small Fermi surface,
this
Z square, does it mean that you have a spherical Fermi surface?
It's a three-dimensional Fermi surface.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the notation, just to be clear, the Brillouin zone you drew down there is the unfolded zone.
Yeah.
But the notation for the orbitals is in the other,
rotated basis. Yeah. I'm sorry about that, yeah. It should be written in small xy. Yeah, we're using this Brillouin zone.
So can I ask a senior question? So the pairing is always in the same band, well actually cross band pairing? So when you talk about the superconducting pairing, it's the pairing only between the same bands?
Pairing. Well, actually, the pairing occurs, well, I'll talk about it later, but the pairing occurs within the same band, but the scattering goes to another band.
So there's an interaction between?
Interaction between bands.
But yeah.
But it must happen within the same band, the K minus K.
Yeah, K
but
minus
but
K.
But it's also like the full, level.
Oh, yeah. It's not like that. It's the pairing is within the band, K minus K.
So people can see the possibility of like a flow pair?
Theoretically?
With shift momentum.
Like, for example, K here and K minus K prime here.
So
like that.
This part with the beta.
Yeah. I'm not sure. You mean theoretically?
You can consider that.
Yeah.
That channel is dead.
Uh-huh.
It does not have Cooper singularity.
So it's like pair with the final momentum.
Like, the momentum is too big.
Yeah, too big.
Yes.
And based on this five orbital model, we consider a multi orbital many body Hamiltonian that considers these multi orbital interactions U, intraorbital, and interorbital U prime. The Fink's coupling J and the pair hopping term, and we apply the random phase approximation to this model. These are the green function, and this is the irreducible susceptibility, and these are the spin and charge susceptibility matrices. And using these spin and charge susceptibilities, we obtain the pairing interaction matrix, and also using this Green function, we get a linearized Elishberg equation, which we solve to obtain the gap function delta and the eigenvalue lambda. And we solve this.
If I may, when are you doing this and use the word Elishberg?
Yeah.
Did you also include fermionic self energy into?
No, in the RPA, no. But in the flex, yes. And actually, I will show some flex results later. So, in that case, yes.
In this fact, this is BCS. So
yes.
Far.
Yes. And so this lambda, the eigenvalue monotonically increases upon lowering the temperature. And TC within this formalism is the temperature where the eigenvalue reaches unity. So in other words, we don't have to necessarily have to go down to low temperatures to obtain TC. Instead, we can stay at a fixed temperature and compare the eigenvalue for different cases to use it as a qualitative measure for TC. And throughout the talk today, I will use that method. And first, I would like to focus on the spin susceptibility. Since the spin fluctuations are mainly governed by the intra-orbital U, the portions of the Fermi surface having similar orbital character mainly contributes to the interaction between portions of the Fermi surface having similar orbital character mainly contributes to the spin susceptibility. So here I plot the portions of the Fermi surface having strong the XZ or YZ character and the X square minus Y square character. This thickness represents the strength of the character. And so the interaction between alpha here and beta here gives rise to the peak in the spin susceptibility within the XZ or YZ orbital. This 3 stands for YZ orbital. And so there are pi 0, 0, pi peak within this XZ, YZ spin susceptibility. And also, there is an interaction between beta here and gamma here. If this gamma Fermi surface is present, then there's an interaction between here and here. And this also gives rise to a pi 0, 0, pi peak. But in this case, in the spin susceptibility within the X square minus, large X square minus Y square spin susceptibility.
Is the chi 3-3 somehow chi 3-3 plus chi, I don't know, 2-2-2 or something? I see the peak. If I think 3 is dyz,
yeah. D-Y-Z, yeah.
I can see a peak at pi 0.
Pi 0, yeah.
Does it also peak at 0 pi, or is that the,
yeah, it's,
or is
it,
that
well, actually,
dxz?
No, it's what dyz.
Yeah, it peaks there.
It peaks here and here.
Thanks. It's a minor point. I would think the dyz would be peaking associated with the red arrow you draw between, say, oh, but you have two alpha 1 and alpha 2.
I think the problem is that the dx set and dy set is in
the diagonal direction. So that's already
it's a mixture.
Mixture. Yes. 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 It's a mixture.
I didn't read the capitals.
Sorry.
Thanks.
And oh yeah, I did mention about this. And also there is an interaction between this electron Fermi surfaces, and this gives rise to this structure around pi pi half, around here. So there are multiple modes of spin fluctuations. And using these spin fluctuations, we consider about spin fluctuation-mediated pairing. Now remember, we have to change the sign of the gap across the wave vector where the spin fluctuation develop. And when the nitrogen height, the position is high, then we have this gamma Fermi surface. So we have a strong interaction between here and here, pi 0, 0, pi interaction. And we have to reverse the sign of the gap across this wave vector. And also there is an interaction between alpha and beta. And so these two modes cooperate to give rise to this S plus minus, fully gapped S plus minus state, where the gap change is sign as plus minus plus along alpha, beta, and gamma. And this will correspond to the well-known S plus minus state, first proposed by Martin et al. And a number of people have studied this state, as you know. And on the other hand, when the position, the Nystrogen position is low, then we don't have this gamma firm surface. We can have the Z square firm surface, but that's not so active because all the other firm surfaces are made of other orbital characters. So I don't have this gamma firm surface when the nitrogen has low. And then this beta-beta interaction becomes more important. And in that case, we have to change the sign of the gap between here and here. And we can do that either in this nodal S-wave form, where the gap changes sign as plus, minus, along the electron firm surface. This is the nodal S-wave state, which was, I think, was first proposed by Glaser et al. And also, a number of people have studied this state, including the FRG study by Wang et al. And Tomao et al.
So the gap, if I look at the origin, so I suppose that my origin, the pi zero point, the gap is like a D wave?
This is the S wave.
No,
this,
yeah, I know.
Oh, so this is the state you're talking about.
Yeah, if I look at the from the point of pi zero.
Yeah.
And the gap changes sine every 90 degrees. That's like D wave.
No, it does change sine every 90 degrees.
Not every 90 degrees, right, when it rotates.
No.
But that's what you mean by minus plus minus.
It's just
but not 90 degrees.
Not 90.
Much closer here and much closer there.
It's S plus 55 degrees.
Consider it S plus D from that point of view.
Uh-huh. So you might just see down pi zero point. It's not that much.
The S wave, and this is the D wave state. We can have nodes on the alpha firm surface, and the electron firm surface are fully gapped here. And these two states are possible states when this gamma firm surface is not present.
Probably minor comment and worth for discussions, not for. Just want to throw away that when we looked into the same problem as you, mm-hmm. we found that most of the time it's like you said.
Yeah.
But I don't think there is a generic theorem that if you have the fifth Fermi surface that you have no nodal S gap, while if you don't have fifth Fermi surface, have nodal S gap. We obtain that mostly like this, mm-hmm. but there is a window of the phase space where even without fifth Fermi surface.
I believe so. Yeah. I think that's. So it's just a general trend, yeah. Mm-hmm. And here I plot the eigenvalue of the Elyashberg equation as a function of the nitrogen height. And as you can see, when the nitrogen height is the nitrogen is at high positions, the eigenvalue of the S-wave state is large, and this open circle means that it's a fully gapped state. So we have a high TC fully gapped sine reversing S plus minus state. But when the nitrogen position becomes low, then this eigenvalue becomes lower and lower, and it finally becomes very close to the D-wave. And this closed circle means that this state has nodes in the superconducting gap. It's a nodal S plus minus state. So we can say that this height can act as a switch between high TC nodeless and low TC nodal pairings. And
you have about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Oh,
5 minutes.
Okay. And well, in that case, so these are the experimental phase diagrams. And this is a plot by Li et al, who found a systematic dependence of TC against the bond angle. And TC is maximized, seems to be maximized at a regular tetrahedron angle. And this is a plot against the height. And there seems to be some maximum around a certain height. So it seems that there's a non-monotonic behavior, and if only the height matters, then we can't understand this non-monotonic behavior because in our theory that I presented, there's only monotonic behavior of TC raising as we increase the height. And as for this, we have been focusing on the fact that the actually as we go from lanthanum to dysprosium, this lattice constant shrinks like this. And applying our theory to structures having a smaller lattice constant, we find that TC decreases. So we can draw a schematic phase diagram like this, where the dashed line are the contours of the TC. So shrinking the lattice constant results in a decrease of the TC. So actually, we are moving around like this, leading to a saturation of the TC. And at the time we were doing this calculation, we were considering that the decrease of the lattice constant results in a decrease of the density of states, and this results in it.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
As far as I can understand, you concentrate here on the change in use by varying the Nicolaitan height on the electronic band structure. So
yeah.
Basically on the one part you talk about this.
Yeah.
But there's clearly also a change on the interaction matrix elements.
Yes.
Even if you work with a simple onset Hubbard U type of description,
yeah.
Because you change maximal localized Wannier functions,
yeah,
you change
yeah,
the screening.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Did you make a study of this effect too?
In this study, no. But well, actually, in this study and the study we are doing now, we have been focusing on the mainly on the effect of the lattice structure. And so in that case, we are just fixing the value of the interaction. But we are also...
Yeah. No, I'm just throwing it down. Well, less than five, definitely less than five.
And so in this case, we're just fixing the interaction.
Also in this case, the Fermi surface structure is identical for different distances, right?
Different, this, yeah, but this changes the entire band.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, it does. And actually, that's what I'm going to talk in the next two or three. That's the most important point. Right? And well, recently we have found out that there is something more to this story. And using the remaining 3 minutes, I will talk about that. This is a relatively new material. It has a perovskite layer in between the iron layers. And this was synthesized by Dr. Eisaki and Dr. Iyo's group. And it has turned out that it has the smallest bond angle in the highest nitrogen height. And its TC of about 28 Kelvin is definitely much lower than the 1111 materials having the highest TC. So in this diagram against bond angle, it lies around here. And recently, Dr. Miyake et al. Have found a very interesting feature, the band structure of this material. This is the band structure in the unfolded Brillouin zone for this new material. And for the comparison, I'll show you the length of 1111. The most important difference is around here, around the gamma point, 0.00. In lanthanum 1111, we have two firm surfaces, alpha 1 and alpha 2. But in this case, there is only one firm surface. And they have also shown how this happened. This is the band structure of a hypothetical lattice structure of this material for different bond angle, fixing the bond length. And this thickness corresponds to the x square minus y square orbital character. And as you go from the large angle, there's two firm surfaces around 0.00, as I said. This corresponds to the low nitrogen case. And as we decrease the bond angle, this gamma firm surface, pi, around pi, shows up. So there are three firm surfaces, whole firm surface now. And as we further decrease the angle, this firm surface disappears. So this, a trend is rather general. We find that this trend is rather general. Even in 1111, if we change the bond angle, this firm surface is first 2, now 3, and then again 2. And this will be the final, the main point of my talk today. If we calculate the eigenvalue of the Elyashberg equation as a function of the bond angle, this red curve is the result. This is obtained by using fluctuation exchange method. And first, this lambda increases, is maximized in the regime where the firm surface is free, and it turns decrease. So it seems
three whole firm surfaces.
Three whole firm surfaces, yeah. So TC seems to be maximized in the regime where there are three whole firm surfaces. And it seems to be consistent with this plot by Lee et al.
But isn't it so somehow expected because there are more scattering?
Yes, yes.
More possibilities.
Yes.
It's the same point you made earlier, right? With the gamma pocket present.
Yeah, this part is true.
Yeah,
okay. But this part.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
Yeah. This part, the decreasing part, yeah. As I said, the gamma firm surface. If the gamma firm surface is
it more about weaker nesting of the electron pockets in the hole pocket? I mean, if I look at the left plot at 100 degrees, the Q electron pockets are way more different than the hole pockets. So the eccentricity of the electron pockets is increased by this.
Yes,
isn't that the main effect?
I think
it's going down like from 110 to 100.
Yeah, that's one point. But as you can see, this results in an increase of the spin susceptibility. So it's not that trivial. Yeah.
And also, of course, this is lambda. TC is different. Right? You need to know prefactor. And prefactor may be different in this case.
What prefactor?
No, but this is coupling, this is lambda.
This?
Yeah,
is,
it's not TC.
It's not TC, yeah.
When you convert this into TC, you need to know also energy scale.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, and energy scale may be different depending on whether you have one, two, or three firm surfaces.
No. That's not.
Why not?
Yeah, because this is the eigenvalue of the Elyashberg equation. So it's the energy scale for these cases are common.
Qualitatively or quantitatively?
you'd have a change from 0.4 to 0.5. Are you saying that the TC is constant times e to minus 1 over lambda in all these cases?
Oh, I mean, well...
It should be more complex than that.
Yeah, it's, of course, it's not linear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. But this general trend, maximized... Yeah. The lambda being maximized around this... okay.
Excuse me. So are you saying that a film surface, a whole pocket for submarine one using is only one? So only one whole pocket?
No. It's three.
Three is the number of whole pockets, not the total number.
Three whole firm surfaces.
Sorry, request from organizer. Yeah. We have so one more talk before break.
Okay. So this will be the summary, and I'll...
Let's leave it for discussion. Before Zlatka moves with his talk, one announcement from organizers. We decided to be bad guys, in some sense. So starting from tomorrow, those who will give not Blackboard, but PowerPoint talks will have less time than those who will give Blackboard talks.
How much time?
You need 10 minutes. Number.
Yeah, quantitative.
10 minutes.
10 minutes less?
Yes.
What if you're using talks?
It doesn't make sense to make a compromise, because I was also thinking about my talk to make both. I mean, if I have some equations and general derivations, I love to do it on the blackboard. But if I want to show some data, I think it's a waste of time not to use it.
Oh, sure.
So can we combine with other penalty?
Sure. We'll just exactly count how much time you spend.
No, I think you can give, two slides grace. 2 slide grace period. Yeah.
So before you start, where is this beautiful structure?
I think it comes with a package. I think it's Frank Gehry's Guggenheim in Bilbao.
That's what I have.
He has, for those of you who go and visit MIT, there is a new library that he built, and apparently MIT is suing him for $80 million, because the thing is, when it rains or snows, the water just comes. In fact, Patrick Lee told me there's a parking garage there, and the snow piles up on the library, and then it just all falls down onto the ramp where you are supposed to get in. So, but on the other hand, he's famous. Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here, and to apologize for coming later than I expected. It had to do with the big snow on the East Coast. So also, let me use this opportunity to mention another workshop this summer in beautiful Aspen, Colorado. There is a workshop. The main theme is nictites again, but really it's a workshop about all interesting developments in a modern theory of superconductivity, with a bit of a reflection to the past. And here is the website. Here is Aspen, these are maroon bells at dawn. And the most importantly, here is the application deadline. And one thing about Aspen is it's a wonderful place, lots of smart people. In fact, one could argue the highest density of smart people anywhere in the summer. But if you don't apply, you don't get in. It's just how it is. And so if you are interested, please make sure that you apply by the deadline. So let me first just say a couple of things that are dear to my heart. I hope you wouldn't mind. This workshop, of course, is about nictites. And in general, we've all been interested in exotic and exciting new high-temperature superconductors. And these superconductors are basically correlated superconductors, which come in at least two varieties. So first of all, we have correlated superconductors where the normal state underlying the superconductivity is some very strongly interacting exotic state. And then, on top of such interesting state, there develops an instability which, by its nature, is somewhat BCS-ish. Of course, the Cooper pairs that are formed, their ingredients could be very unusual degrees of freedom. Surely, this superconductor could be having all sorts of unusual properties. But in principle, superconductivity is instability riding a piggyback on this very unusual normal state. I guess everyone would agree that superfluid helium 3 is in this category. Many people would argue that heavy fermions are as well, also organics, electron-doped cuprates. Now, some people would argue that all cuprates are in this category. And of course, lots of people, well, some people would argue that perhaps iron nictates are in this category. And then, of course, we have materials where superconducting state itself is intrinsically very strongly correlated. In other words, it is very, very far, and in fact, in certain sense, can be orthogonal to BCS description. And of course, people... Well, what it means, for example, it could have very strong pairing correlations, which lead to some measurable experimental consequences, but the ground state is not a superconductor. What is interesting about this state is that even though the ground state may end up not being a superconductor, the normal state then, in fact, almost plays a second fiddle to the superconducting correlation. So it's a bit like an inverted picture. It is the properties of a superconductor that determine the properties of adjacent normal states. Now, there is a very good question whether this type of state is realized anywhere. And there are lots of, there are some people at least, who would argue that it is realized in whole underdoped cuprates. And of course, it's a very interesting possibility to think that some of it may be realized in iron nictates, or for instance, iron chalcogenides, selenides, and tellurides. In fact, there are recent papers arguing that these materials are quite a bit more strongly correlated than nictates.
Certainly, the same people would argue that some organics should go down in that column as well.
Yes, so it is for that very purpose that this is not a subject of my talk, yes. Exactly, because I don't want to argue with this group or that group of people. I say this because I want to illustrate what, in my view, is the main difference between cuprates and nictates. In both cases, we have two-dimensional, quasi-two-dimensional systems. We have the electrons playing a key role. And we have antiferromagnetism and superconductivity in close vicinity to each other. But on the other hand, there are some important differences. And these differences are very simple in my mind. One is that iron has 6, whereas copper has 9 d electrons. And so if we write an effective theory of copper O2 plane, we can in principle get away with an effective one-band model. I've been at this very place and many other places where brilliant members of our community went at each other full force over this argument. I'm sure Doug remembers. But in principle, at least, it is possible to write some effective one-band model for copper oxide. We cannot do that for iron nictates, as Professor Kuroki has showed us. These are much more complicated systems. And of course, in copper oxides, many people believe, in fact, lots of people believe, I think that's experimental fact, that the ground state of a parent compound is a Mott-type insulator, which of course turns into an antiferromagnet precisely at half filling. And only upon doping can the holes, so electrons, move around. And you end up with, resistivity, which seems to be taking a downturn, and eventually it becomes superconducting. And this is, the famous diagram, and I'm not going to discuss it at all any longer, except just to say that this is where most people believe any reflection of this Mott correlation in cuprates takes place.
Okay.
This is the whole underdoped regime of cuprates. In nictates, on the other hand, nictates are failed semiconductors. Basically, you have a conduction band and a valence band, and by accident of nature, Hideo Hosono, being a brilliant man as he is, was making these for the purpose of making variable gap semiconductors, and then every once in a while, a gap ends up being negative. They put things and measure the low temperature properties, and voila, it's a superconductor. And of course, in these materials, we can think of hole pockets and electron pockets as being almost empty or almost filled, and that makes it easier for holes and electrons, as the case may be, to move around. And therefore, just on this simple basis, one would naively argue that nictates are in fact somewhat less correlated than cuprates. Of course, this less can be quantified, and one can argue whether they are still on a Mott side or not. People who do dynamical mean field calculation, dynamical mean field theory calculations, they would say that model for nictates is just on the weaker side of a Mott critical value. They put effective U for these materials at about 80% of critical value that's needed to get into Mott regime. So these are strongly interacting systems, but may have not crossed that boundary yet. That's what I will assume anyway. If you look at their phase diagram, it looks very similar, of course. Everybody knows everything about this, but I just want to motivate the rest of my talk. If you look at the phase diagram, there's a close proximity of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, just like in cuprates. But unlike cuprates, all the phases that we see in this phase diagram at all dopings are metallic. Remember, cuprates were insulating very close to half filling. These materials are metallic. So I'm going to think that they are, at least one can get ahead by thinking initially of them as itinerant. Now we can cook up a model, and this model was quickly cooked up, well, quickly constructed, a very elegant model by Professor Kuroki, by Peter, and his friends, and by many other people. And basically, you end up with at least one elementary description of this is two hole pockets and two electron pockets at gamma and m points respectively. And then, of course, comes the unhappy circumstance, which is that the orbital structure of these pockets is, in fact, very rich. And it's rich in a particularly nasty manner for someone like me who has difficulty calculating anything. And so we discover that in addition to DXZ and DYZ bands, which have to be there, we also have to include the xy and the x squared minus y squared. In the worst possible way, these are important near gamma point, these are important near m point. And turns out this one is not that big, but once we have four of them, we might as well include five. And so this, of course, leads to complexity in this model. And we have to worry about whether any simple picture can, in fact, be drawn at all. In terms of simple orbital topology, there is none. As you go around these pockets around the Fermi surface, there is none. So one thing that...
There's none what?
Some simple orbital topology. This is a reference to if you do DYZ and DXZ orbitals only, there's a beautiful piece of orbital topology. There is a vortex in K-space that's located at gamma point. You see? And that has tremendous consequences for computing everything, you see, because it is a kind of a protective node in that space. Unfortunately, when dxy and dx squared minus y squared come in, that's washed away, the same way that vortex in O2 is washed away if you go into O3 and up. So sadly, these effects are important, and so we cannot just use a simple picture. We have to include all these bands. Then, of course, there is nesting that Professor Kuroki has mentioned. This is a standard logarithmic type singularity, which leads to enhancement in susceptibility. And therefore, in a system that has moderate interactions, this is going to produce a density wave at pi pi at m wave vector. At this point, of course, we don't necessarily know what kind of density wave that is, but we surely know the main dynamical mechanism for it, which is just this. We just want to open a gap at this point after particle hole rotation. It's really just a Cooper singularity in particle hole space. And so one can go ahead and try to study this from an itinerant side. We write some Hamiltonian. This is going to be, say, Professor Kuroki's Hamiltonian or some variation of that. Say, Savatsky Hamiltonian. Savatsky and collaborators have a very nice paper, Jan Zanin, in which they write generic, enormous sausage of the orbital interactions that are relevant for nictates. And here is all of them. And here is, of course, the band structure we started with. And we'll be assuming that interactions are moderate in size. I've already stressed that. And we will also be assuming that the Hund's coupling is small. In other words, this system, we will assume, is not close to uniform ferromagnetic instability. Many people initially thought, including myself, this would be a wonderful way to get a P-wave superconductor through paramagnon fluctuations near approximate ferromagnetic transition. That if you compute these susceptibilities, what you find is here is the Q equal to zero peak, and here is vroom, pi pi peak rising above the background. So that will not work. Is that okay? Am I too poetic or am I?
Or? A little bit too poetic, but keep going.
Okay.
Actually, it happens in a lithium iron arsenic, which is a P wave superconductor, probably.
That happens? Probably, yes. Probably.
Yeah.
So anyway, let me make my point now.
I just have one little comment. For Hunton, point A is very large.
Yes, so there is a factor that comes in here. So I think this actually includes that.
Yeah, this is actually very large.
Well, it's OK.
Well, OK. So thank you. I appreciate your comment. So what I will assume is that J Hund's is much smaller than UD, so that I can, whenever I have terms which compare UD and JH, I will resolve those terms in favor of UD. But I hope you can forgive me for that.
Slotka, you have about 5 minutes, so I respectfully suggest you get to the point.
Okay, I will do that.
A little bit more.
Okay.
Leave that for discussion.
We want to leave that for discussion.
Okay.
Start writing something on the board, then you get some additional points.
Only tomorrow.
Okay. Okay, so we can compute. I first of all, point taken. Thank you for informing me of this. I was going very slowly. On the other hand, the previous speaker was not. We can compute effective interactions coming from these terms on the Fermi surface. And all I want to stress here is that we get two kinds of vertices. We get vertices that are flavor conserving. So now I'm writing on a blackboard, which immediately buys me extra 10 minutes. So there is a,
yeah, but they're raising excursion.
There is an interaction with this. Thank you. There is an interaction of this type, for instance. E1 comes in, E1 comes out. And so that's simply what is meant by flavor conserving. So for instance, E1 comes in, E1 comes out. H2 comes in, H2 comes out. So here, a vortex flavor is conserved. Or we can have vertices that E1 comes in, but H2 comes out. And this would be an example of a flavor changing vertex. And so there are two types of terms of this kind, and I can classify all terms into these two categories. Now, all of these terms have very strong orbital dependence around the Fermi surface. And this has been computed by a number of people. So in view of the lateness of the hour, I'm just going to ignore all of this. And I'm just going to look at S wave. And so if you have questions, you can then ask me. The only thing I want to say, we can compute all of these elements of this orbital dependence. And we see indeed that the terms that are flavor conserving, vertices, interactions that are flavor conserving, are larger than those that are flavor changing.
Sorry. Can you UWG1G2?
Yes.
So
What are these terms?
Yes, exactly.
So let me go ahead and show you. Okay. So I have that in detail later on. So I'm going to jump now in view of the lateness of the hour. I'm going to jump through this. Everybody knows everything about this. This is just an explanation of how one does computation in this realmization group type theory. Many people have done this. So please, I'm just jumping through this, forced by punctual organizers. And so now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to use the fact that these vertices are generically much larger than these to construct an effective theory of this problem and answer your question. So the way to do that, I already said, I'm starting with an itinerant picture, and then I simply assume that all these pockets are identical. And this gives me a theory that has an internal SU8 symmetry. Of course, that's way too much. There is nothing like that in the real system, as we have elliptical shape, pockets are not of the same size, and so on. So the key assumption that I make, the differences among pockets are much smaller than the overall properties.
Differences due, for example, to ellipticity and so on.
Yes, exactly. So ellipticity is small, delta KF is small compared to KF. Then there is this strong orbital character of vertices. That, as I said, has been discussed by many people. I'm going to assume that flavor-conserving vertices are much larger than flavor-violating vertices, which is true if this is satisfied. So now I want to answer your question. This is an example of a flavor-conserving vertices. So this is a U vertex. Everybody is E1, or everybody is E2, or everybody is H1. This is a W vertex. This is the one that mediates EH density wave instabilities. These are of the order of bandwidth in this description. These are flavor-changing vertices. And they are much smaller because they involve momentum transfer by pi. I just throw them away. And so the effective theory is now U4 cross U4 symmetric. I can rotate holes and electrons any which way I want into each other. So now I solve this theory. There's nothing to do, really.
And you also neglect Unklapp terms, right, at this stage?
Well, I can include
two holes into two electrons.
I include. That's all neglected. So at U8, U4 cross U4 level, there is no superconductivity.
Okay.
This is all for parent compound, right?
Sure.
Here.
Okay.
So now I've had a long a slide here which shows why is this reasonable to do with respect to the experiment. But now I'm going to say this is reasonable to do with respect to the time I have left, which is none. So please forgive me. I just do it. And then these are the assumptions. I repeat them here. All the deviations from this symmetry are much smaller than the overall terms. I can solve this U4 cross U4 theory. It's a piece of triviality. And the solution is an order parameter, which is an overall order parameter times 4x4 unitary matrix. And this unitary matrix describes spin density wave, pocket density waves, charge density waves, all rolled in into one. All of these states are mutually orthogonal to each other. And any one of them can be a solution. There is a huge degeneracy involved. And so the energy scale that's associated with these states, with this U4 cross U4 symmetry, is a large energy scale, from bandwidth down to TNL. Now I borrow something from particle physics. David is here. So I steal stuff from particle physics. U4 cross U4 is my ultraviolet theory. And now I compute low energy physics by simply inserting all the terms that I've dropped away previously and compute their effect to leading order alone. So I just go and compute that. It turns out the most important terms that break this symmetry, by the way, now the symmetry is broken to nothing, meaning the original symmetry of iron nictates, which is really nothing. The most important such terms are G1 and G2. G2 is Chubukov term, electron-electron into hole-hole, the one that causes plus-minus superconductivity. Correction to that term is something like this. It doesn't matter what it is. The only thing that matters for us is that this term is positive. If we want to have electron-only plus-minus superconductivity, this term has to be positive. It turns out the effect of this term is to fix the phase of different density waves. And therefore, the ground state is either spin density wave or imaginary spin singlet density wave, which is just really a current. Okay? This is unfolded zone, by the way. From G1, which is this term, E1 H2, H2 E1, this is the term that's enhanced by Hund's, and it's therefore smaller. There, we can think of it as a matrix in this complicated problem, and we look at its eigenvalues, which have to be real because of the action of G2. And here is where the interesting thing is. If you actually compute these terms together, you discover that in this regime where Hund's rule is not terribly important, typically one eigenvalue of G1 is very small. One is positive, as it should be. The other one is very small, but positive, but very small. And so imagine for a moment that we had some electron-follower interaction in a system, which does in fact enhance G1. Electron-follower interactions are thought to be rather weak in these materials, but of course they could surely turn around this lambda 1, or at any rate, lambda 1 is very close to 0. What does this mean? This is my last slide, so I will just show you. I take this. These are the most important symmetry-breaking terms, the leading terms, and there are two main predictions of this. First, well, there is a zeroth order prediction, which is that we are close to this quantum critical point where one eigenvalue of this G1 term is around zero. The first prediction is that spin density wave is accompanied by pocket density wave, which is imaginary in the opposite direction. And that's really just a current. So here is a current pattern that accompanies spin density wave. Now, there is another possibility. One whole pocket, H2, is very different from the others. So if the interactions are quite weak, weaker than the difference between all pockets and H2, H2 will remain ungapped. In the limit where it's bigger, where interactions are bigger than this difference, but still of the order of bandwidth, this is the scenario that will happen.
Right. But you still need to change the sign of lambda to get this.
Lambda has to be negative.
Negative,
absolutely.
Right. And in calculation, it appears still positive.
So in the calculation that I performed, lambda, all eigenvalues of lambda of G1 are always positive.
Right, just like in G, the same story.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of them is very small. And actually, that has to do with orbital structure. There is no principle here. It has to do with orbital structure. It does not flip the sun, as far as we know. Mm-hmm. But it's very small. So I'm saying, if it's very small, electron-phonon interaction, as small as they are, could flip it over. That's the only place, actually, where electron-phonon interactions have influence in this picture.
Very small means what? Is that just
among the Eliasberg people, of which Igor Mazin is one very reputable one, actually, very smart man, he would say electron-phonon interactions are quite weak in these materials.
I'm asking about your one eigenvalue.
Compared to what? So eigenvalue, for instance, in the scale of inverse density of states, this eigenvalue is 0.02.
And that's an accident?
But it's a number.
It's a number. It's an accident.
But wait a second. If you look at the situation when what you call, I guess, G2, density-density interaction. Sorry.
Yes.
Exchange density-density interaction, the one with momentum transfer pi is zero, then I guess one of your lambda will be exactly zero. This is where orbital vertex is the same as spin density wave vertex.
Well, that's a special point, yes.
Right. And you go a little bit away from this special point. Yes. So this lambda 0.2 is just a consequence of whatever number you put for this extra interaction. It's proportional to this interaction.
No. We should talk some more about that. You see, generically, this eigenvalue receives contributions from UD, from interorbital U, from J. Hund's, from many, many terms that you had in your Hamiltonian. It's just some number. But generically, one eigenvalue is positive and large, one is very small.
No, I agree with this. But if you reflect everything in band picture,
yes.
Then I just follow the steps that you follow.
Yes.
That you said that if you eliminate any interaction with momentum transfer pi, you get U4 cross U4 symmetry.
Well, no. This is beyond that now.
This is beyond that. Right. But it's small deviation. And my impression is that lambda is small because it's a small deviation from U4 cross.
But is it positive or negative? That's the question.
Right. It's positive, but it's proportional to the strength of the interaction that brings you away from U4 cross U4.
It is. So it is always positive. It is always positive unless I bring phonons in.
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to point out that I have been here for almost an entire week and not gotten a single cookie because they're all gone. But
well, so you see, how can one, even I don't feel self-important enough to take on my big shoulders denying people cookies. But the truth is, you see, I've been at conferences where previous speaker is allowed to go on and on and on and on. And then I'm cut and shut down. And I remain bitter for the rest of my life. Okay, anyway, so these are two main predictions. The structural transition is always above. T-nail, close, but above. This is the state. Now, as discussion with Andre and Peter just revealed, of course, we could have two spin density waves. But if we have two spin density waves, there is no standard stripe antiferromagnet.
Right. But then we know that one of them is selected and another is not.
Well, yes, that's one possibility, obviously. And so one just has to look for this. And so let me end, therefore, the cookie time is here. I just want to show you nice data from our old friend, Bob Virginal, on neutron scattering. And this is a magnetic, antiferromagnetic transition in 1111 and 122. And the point on this graph is that the critical behavior of the two, when magnetic and structural transition coincide, and when they are separated, is different. And they themselves wrote down that this might be a consequence of higher symmetry. So maybe this is somehow related to this possibility of U4 cross U4 symmetry, which comes in. Of course, eventually, that symmetry is broken by the small terms. But as long as we are not incredibly close to the transition, this is the relevant symmetry. And so now it's cookie time. Thank you. Sorry for going over time.
So Zlatko isn't bitter for the rest of his life, maybe we should allow one or two questions.
Maybe just for clarification, Zlatko, going back to the slides that you so nicely clicked one after another.
Yes.
Isn't it the same as when you write RG?
Yes.
And you have vortices in different channels. One of the channels is imaginary charge density wave channel.
Yes.
Which is exactly the same current that you're talking about.
Yes.
And it always comes close second without electron-phonon interaction.
Absolutely.
Namely, it's different from spin density wave, becomes smaller and smaller.
And the difference between the two is governed by the small eigenvalue of this matrix.
Which in RG flows zero comparable to other couplings.
Exactly.
So just to understand. So you're saying that if one adds electron-phonon interaction, then
this might be flipped around.
Might mean that you didn't do calculations to RG including electron-phonon interaction.
Well,
just assumption that it will flip around and will gum.
Exactly. It might flip around.
Thanks.
Exactly. That's all.
Just understand.
We could.
So what I'm trying to say, in everybody's calculation, this eigenvalue is anomalously small.
Yes.
It is not a result of principle, but it's a result of particular structure of these equations.
Sure.
In other words, I'm laboring to stress something you know, but maybe I should stress it for everybody else. This U4 cross U4 symmetry is not a beautiful emergent symmetry of the type that condensed matter physicists often drool over. This is a real ultraviolet symmetry that is really broken at low energies. It just serves for us to organize our bookkeeping. And so my argument is that in some of the nictites, we might have a state of this kind. Just because, due to electron-phonon interaction, you flip on the other side.
Questions?
Go ahead.
So actually, it seems to me that you won't cross your answer is very important, but you flip very quickly because of time.
Yes, I did.
So because you will cross your frequency, you have a full copy of the electron band, full copy of the hole,
Yes, counting speed, okay. Yes.
The speed part of the...
So spin and orbital is all mixed in here. So this is a one particular way of democratically mixing spin and orbital.
The,
after I include all these terms, the residual symmetry is nothing. It's a symmetry of iron lactates.
Speed and flavor. It's missing of spin and flavor.
It's missing of spin and flavor, which is the pocket flavor. But pocket flavor itself, you see, once you include the vertices, pocket flavor itself can be connected to orbitals.
Right, but not in U4 cross U4 point. Then you mix spin and flavor.
Yeah,
because
sure.
So far,
sure.
It's just.
Yes, yes.
So absolutely. The spin is part of this U4 cross U4. The spin is embedded.
Yes, it's embedded in this. Yes, exactly. So exactly, orbital is completely mixed up inside the pocket flavor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.